Welcome back to The Grand Conversation, Machon Siach Podcast. Machon Siach at SAR High School, honoring the memory of Belda Kaufman Lindenbaum Zichrona Livracha, is the research arm of SAR High School, where faculty bridge theory and practice on matters of Jewish education, curriculum, and culture. I am your host, Shmuel Hain, Rosh Beit Midrash at SAR High School. Our producer is Avi Bloom, and our engineer is Greg Schmidt. This episode of The Grand Conversation is the second part of our new series on American Jews and higher education. This series explores the experience of American Jews in higher education and considers the challenges raised not only by the ongoing war in Gaza, but also by the broader shifts in the academy and campus culture, as well as changes in law and policies around admissions, discrimination, and free speech. Our first episode with Dr. Rivka Press-Schwartz focused on the history of American Jews in higher education. This second episode was recorded at a Machon Siach event last year, before October 7th. It features a discussion between Dr. Schwartz, Rabbi Hartstark, and Professor Daniel Markovitz of Yale Law School about the impact of the college admissions process on our students and on American society more generally. Dr. Schwartz is our guest host for this fascinating grand conversation.
Tonight, we are going to be talking about college and thinking about college. But tonight, we're not thinking about and approaching the topic of college from the narrow questions of applications, admissions, and who gets in. We're thinking more about the college process writ large and how that is a part of, a reflection of, and a contributor to much larger issues going on in the lives of our kids, in the lives of our community, and maybe the life of our country. We are honored, grateful, and excited to be joined tonight by Professor Daniel Markovitz, the Guido Calabresi Professor of Law at Yale Law School, and the director of the Center for the Study of Private Law. And fascinated as we are by the study of private law, that's not why we asked Professor Markovitz to join us tonight. We asked him to join us tonight because of a book of his that we came across when it came out a couple of years ago called The Meritocracy Trap: How America's Foundational Myth Feeds Inequality, Dismantles the Middle Class, and Devours the Elite. Now, Professor Markovitz may have been more interested or more invested in the first two parts of that subtitle, Defeating the Inequality and Dismantling the Middle Class. But when I first read this book, I was really struck by its descriptions of how meritocracy, the striving to be the best or at least good enough to make it to all of the markers of success and achievement, the college admissions and then the graduate school admissions and then the job and then excelling at the job, and what we've sometimes internally within SAR High School referred to as the hamster wheel, how much what he was describing sounded like what I see in the lives of our high school kids and in the lives of our families. And so while he might have been mapping out broader patterns and descriptions in American society, it also sounded to me like he was describing something very specific to us that manifests in the lives of our kids, in the lives of our families, the lives of our community. And all you have to do is look at the amount of sign-up we had for this evening and the number of people who are joining to know how much this question, this issue, and this topic resonates within our school community. And so this evening's program is going to be structured as follows. First, we're going to take the first 20 minutes or so of this program to talk to Professor Markovitz about his work and to ask him some questions about the work in general and how we might map it onto our community and our kids in particular. And then we're going to ask Rachel Hartstark, founding principal of SAR High School and Dean of Machon Siach, to join the conversation to talk a little bit about how we see these things playing out in our community and ultimately what we might begin to do to think about and even address the issues that we've raised. So to move on to the first part of this evening, Professor Markovitz, again, thank you so much for joining us. And I want to start by asking you, what brought you to write about this topic? I imagine this isn't exactly what you usually work on or where your scholarship usually is. What motivated you to study, research, and write about this?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me, and nice to see so many faces, and I hope we get a chance to have a back and forth. In direct answer to the question, I think that there were two kinds of motivations for me. One was scholarly, and I'll just gloss over it pretty quickly, which is that there is a tradition in thinking about economic inequality in the sort of Anglo-American world of philosophy and political theory, which thinks about inequality as wrong because people are not rewarded in proportion to their choices. And the idea is that in a perfectly just world, everybody would get the full benefit of their good choices and the full burden of their bad choices, but wouldn't in any way be suffering an unchosen disadvantage. And for a variety of reasons, that approach to economic inequality seemed to me just to miss what was actually going on, which is that we live in a world in which a lot of people are making what seem like really very good choices, but they are at the same time being disproportionately rewarded for them. So that the choice to work really hard in school, to do really well in school, to go get a job where you get paid a huge amount of money, it didn't seem right to say that the person who has that life course is just like the person who inherits an aristocratic estate. That person didn't choose it. They just inherited it. Whereas the person who ends up being a high up at Goldman Sachs made a series of choices all the way along the way, but it still didn't seem like they necessarily deserved all their advantage. And I wanted to get to the bottom of that. So that was the academic intellectual part. The part that's probably more directly connected to this conversation has two components. The first is I attended elite private universities, but I attended not elite public high schools. And the kids I went to high school with, I would say, were just as naturally gifted as the kids I went to Yale Law School with. But their life outcomes weren't at all the same. And that's not surprising if you live in our world. But I wanted to try to understand exactly what the mechanism was that produced that massive difference. And then on the other hand, my students now at Yale Law School, and this goes directly to what you were saying in your introduction, I think 25 years ago, when I started teaching at Yale Law School, my students thought they had won the lottery and were pretty pleased with themselves and their circumstances. But increasingly over time, my students at Yale Law School, on the one hand, have a feeling that their advantage is somehow connected to other people's disadvantage in ways that they can't quite put their finger on, but that make them morally uncomfortable. And on the other hand, they feel like the price of all their status and income is that they give up their authentic ambitions and their freedom in ways that are really harmful to them. And again, they have a strong sense of uncertainty, disaffection, alienation that I also thought they couldn't quite put their finger on. And one thing I was trying to do in the book is to give an account of why that is happening to them and to explain structurally this vivid sensibility that they have, but which I think previously remained inarticulate.
So before we get into the ways that those broader structural factors and forces manifest specifically in the lives of the kids who are, you know, in an elite private school, a particular kind of elite private school, a religiously organized elite private school, but a private school the same, before we get into how those forces manifest specifically in the lives of our kids, can you map out for us a little bit of what is this bigger structure or pattern that you're describing and seeing?
Yeah, so very simply, so until the day before yesterday, or the day before yesterday is probably 1980. People who were rich because they owned things. So initially they were aristocrats and they owned a lot of land. Then came the Industrial Revolution and they were factory owners. So they owned factories and machines. And in 1960, three quarters, four fifths of the income of the richest 1% of US Americans came from capital. And maybe five, six, or seven eighths of the income of the richest 10th of 1% of Americans came from capital. And so the rich didn't work for a living. They got their money by owning things. Then in the years between 1960 and 1980, and really accelerating after 1980, the sources of income and wealth changed. So that the richest 1% of US Americans today get about three quarters of their income by selling their own labor. And the richest 10th of 1% of US Americans, these are people with household income in excess of $1.5 million, $2 million a year, get maybe two thirds of their income by selling their own labor. And that has two consequences. One consequence is that if you are rich because you own things, because you're a capitalist, because you own land or factories, you can mix your capital with other people's labor, extract a surplus and live on it so that your wealth makes you free. But if you're rich because you own your own labor, your own elite training and super skill, the only way to get income out of your wealth is by mixing it with your own labor and devoting yourself to whatever task the market will pay for. And so at that point, your extreme wealth makes you unfree. And you become the classic person who really would like to have been a teacher or a nurse or an artist, but realizes that if you want to stay rich, you have to be a banker at Goldman Sachs or a partner at Simpson Thatcher or go work at Meta or go work at Google. And those are not things you actually want to do, but it's the only way you can get income out of all your wealth, which is in your own training. So the one mechanism is that the elite in the United States today is much richer than ever before, but much less free than it used to be. And then the other mechanism is that the way in which you build skill and human capital is through education and training. And so the way in which this new, I call it a meritocratic elite, transmits its privilege down through its generations is by investing enormously in educating its children. So it spends much more on private schooling, much more on tutors, much more on enrichment activities. And the way in which the old aristocrats passed their privilege down to their children is they just died and the children inherited their estates. But the way in which today's meritocrats pass their privilege down is through this extremely intense, it's both resource intense and skill and labor intense process of training up its kids. So they then have the same wealth that the parents have, which is their own training in human capital, which they can then deploy by selling their labor for enormous sums of money. And so this produces, as you said, this infinite hamster wheel. The difference is it's a very, very large wheel and has very good restaurants on it, but it's still a spinning hamster wheel. And that's the condition that I was trying to get a hold of.
And it was that when I read your book that so resonated, because again, you were describing graduates of Yale Law School who are going on to whatever, but I saw my high school students.
Yeah.
Kids. I remember the first time after, when I write letters of recommendation for my students applying to college all the time. And the first time a student who was already in college asked for a letter of recommendation for the next thing they were applying to. And then came the next thing and the next thing, because right. There's always another gold star to win on your ongoing climb to the top. And so I think we want to talk now about the impacts that living under this meritocratic system has on the people who are nominally officially succeeding in the system. They're making it. They're reaping the rewards. But as you say, both at high cost for the people who are at the top and have to keep working, which is, you know, less our concern here right now, although maybe we want to talk about that also. But also you don't just get there by being born into it and sent to a certain New England prep school by virtue of your last name. You have to earn your place in those elite schools, which you earn by amassing all of the credentials along the way. And it's a ton of work. And we are looking at high school students who are working really hard, facing a lot of stress. We as a school feel like we've done various things over the years actually to try to lessen the amounts of stress our students are under. And yet their stress levels seem to only be increasing and climbing. And so I wonder if you could talk to the effects of this meritocratic system, again, specifically on the people who are supposed to be succeeding in it.
Sure. And I think there are two things to say about it, and both apply already in high school. The first is that intense and long work under conditions of surveillance, evaluation, and therefore stress is just in itself very difficult to take for long periods of time. And so, you know, your students, my kids go to a private high school here. I mean, I talked to lots of other elite high schools, students at all these places. They have enormous amounts of work. They're constantly evaluated and assessed. They're exhausted from doing the work. And they're frightened that if they don't do well, they won't measure up and they won't clear the next bar. And it's not just that they're looking for gold stars because they have some perverse attraction to the sheen. It's also that, in fact, if they don't clear the next bar, material consequences will follow that they have reason not to like. They won't get into the college they want to get into. They won't get into the professional school they want to get into. They won't get the job that they want. And their lives will be more precarious. So that their response to this system of intense extraction of effort coupled with surveillance and evaluation isn't irrational. It's rational. They have reason to respond the way in which they do, but that only makes it all the harder for them. So that's the first part, which is just sort of the banal effortfulness and exhaustion of living that way. The second part, which is, I think, equally important, but a little bit more abstract, is that when you live that way, you quite literally use yourself up. You treat yourself not as a person who has interests and desires and wants and needs and authentic passions, but instead as an asset. And you're like a portfolio manager whose portfolio contains yourself. And you'll make whatever trade is needed to maximize the value of your portfolio, which is to say, you'll study the things that you need to study in order to get the evaluations that you need. You know, right now it's much easier in the US, for example, to distinguish yourself in the natural sciences and the humanities, because our society tracks in the natural sciences, has lots of different APs in the natural sciences. And so kids study the natural sciences because if you want to show that you're a really elite student, that's the way to do it. You can't show that you're a really elite student by knowing, being a really sensitive reader of literature. It's very hard to do. And so what that does is it pushes people to mold themselves to somebody else's values rather than to pursue their own passions. And eventually they lose even the ability to form their own passions because they get so used to molding themselves. And that's not just exhausted, that's a kind of alienation. In fact, it is very close structurally to what Marx described as alienated labor. One thing that this system has done is it has moved alienated and exploited labor out of the working class and into the elite, which now works under precisely the kinds of conditions that Marx described. The only difference is that the elite captures the benefit of its own exploitation. So we now have elite alienated labor that is wealthy, but it's still alienated and exploited, and therefore it's not well. And that's a kind of an existential condition that this system imposes on people, especially actually on those who purportedly are winning.
So this is a fairly grim picture, and we're going to come back. We're going to sit with the grim. We're going to come back to the grim soon. But before we do, I actually would like to ask a question. I don't know if pushing back is quite the right thing to say, but the American Jewish experience, which the people on this Zoom call are all descendants of and participants in, is a story of people genuinely making it from conditions of poverty, maybe refugee status, maybe Holocaust survivor, maybe just impoverished immigrant, and by dint of the story we tell ourselves anyway, leaving out for a minute the racial and other kinds of critique, by dint of hard work, investment in education, all those other things, we have over a series of 2-3 generations gone from being pushcart peddlers or penniless refugees to being white collar professionals sitting in our suburban houses.
Right. I mean, my grandfather arrived in America in my great-grandmother's womb after his father had been killed in the pogrom. And now I'm a professor at Yale Law School. And that's the generational story you're describing. And I think that there are two things to say about it. The first is that this kind of meritocratic system is in a certain way genuinely emancipatory. If the alternative was one or another form of aristocracy in which you inherited your privilege, and that meant that your privilege was based on your race, your ethnicity, your religion. In other words, you had to be basically a white Protestant to really be at the top of this particular social order. Obviously, there's going to be massive inequality and exclusion. And because meritocracy, to some degree, evaluates people individually based on their accomplishments, and because no group has a monopoly on accomplishment, all kinds of people who were traditionally excluded could get into the elite by this system. And that's a real virtue that the system has. That doesn't necessarily mean it produces more equality, actually. It might just shuffle the elite. A place to see this very clearly, actually, is with respect to race. So the reason we now have in the United States a black elite is meritocracy, because previously, if you were African American, you were excluded by de jure racial discrimination from elite jobs. And today, if you achieve, you can have an elite job, regardless of your race. At the same time, as we now have a Black elite in the United States, the white-Black income and wealth gap, on average, has gone up. Because the other thing that meritocracy has done is has massively distended the distribution of income, massively increased inequality. And when you have a sort of base level of structural racism, then the same mechanism that allows elites to break out of the structural racism and become members of the elite, even as African-Americans, also on average harms the population that is at the bottom of the racist hierarchy. And so you can both have the creation of a Black elite and the exacerbation of the white-Black income and wealth gap, and the same mechanism can produce them both. The same mechanism can produce them both. And so what we see in this situation is that it's a very complicated moral phenomenon in which some things about the system are admirable, others I think are deplorable, and often it's the same thing that's both admirable and deplorable at the same time.
Right, and I think that's the thing that's important for us to, there are certainly going to be people hearing this and hearing the decrying of the many, many negative effects of this reality that we live with, which again, we see in our school and in our kids all the time, but also saying over the generations, that same system, or at least in its earlier manifestations, made it possible for my parents to rise from where they did and to achieve what they did. And so holding that, there's going to be, aside from all the other reasons why people are uncomfortable with challenges to the meritocracy, including that the kinds of structural reforms that you suggest would be a profound reordering of American society. There are many people from this particular community who feel like, I don't know, seems like it actually did what it promised to do.
Right.
And I'm reluctant to upset the apple cart.
Right. And the sentiment that it to some degree did what it promised to do is not mistaken. That's part of the power of this system. Look, you know, most ideologies, including ideologies of inequality, have something to say for themselves. If they didn't, they wouldn't be as popular and powerful as they are. And maybe let me have, if I can have one more second, just a related thought. It might be worth distinguishing between two concepts, excellence on the one hand and superiority on the other. Right. Excellence involves being good at something that's worth doing and being good enough to make it have the value that makes it worth doing. So if I'm a doctor and I can help people who are sick get well, I'm an excellent doctor. All right. Superiority involves being better at something than somebody else. A big difference between excellence and superiority is that excellence is a threshold concept. Once I'm good enough at the thing that's worth doing to make it worth doing, I'm excellent at it. And the fact that somebody else is a little bit better at it doesn't make me no longer excellent. Whereas superiority is a rank concept. As soon as somebody else is a little better than I am, I'm no longer superior. In addition, excellence has a substantive component. To be excellent at something, it has to be worth doing. Whereas you can be superior at things that aren't worth doing. And what our meritocracy has done is it has produced a cultural fetish for superiority, even at the cost of excellence. And so we are rewarding people for being better than other people at things that may or may not be worth doing. And we're creating lots of jobs which are incredibly highly paid and incredibly highly statused because they are opportunities for displaying superiority. And then we're demoting everybody who isn't superior, even though maybe doing that work is not actually that particularly socially valuable or worthwhile. High frequency trading in capital markets is like this. It has a social product of zero. But if you can be superior to the next person at it, you can make hundreds of millions of dollars.
So I had planned to ask you another question, but I actually think this is a great place to ask Vitaly Hartstark to join the conversation. Because this conversation is about excellence and superiority gets at something that he has raised and expressed concern about before in our, you know, as an administration, we have ongoing conversations about this. And is there a way to get us all off the hamster wheel? I'm not going to speak for Hervé Hartstark. I'll hand you the microphone in a minute. But one of the questions Hervé Hartstark has often raised is, isn't there something of value in our kids striving and driving and wanting to achieve. And if, you know, is the question about settling for some kind of lack of drive, and is something lost thereby? And I think that maybe this excellence and superiority distinction is a really interesting one to throw out there. So Rabbi Hartstark, we can jump into the conversation from there. Professor Markovitz just threw out a very interesting distinction between superiority and excellence, and the idea that maybe kids could still be driven for excellence, which means being really good at something that matters without having to be better than other people, which might be better than other people at something that matters, or actually it might be better than other people at something that doesn't matter. Where, again, to focus specifically on what we're talking about in the entire college process, which has come to dominate kids' entire high school experience, it really comes to be about establishing superiority, right? It's not enough to start a club, you have to head a club. It's not enough to head a club, you have to innovate. It's not enough to innovate, you have to find the cure for cancer. Because we're talking about, again, I think it's really important to stop and say that we are talking about this as a universal phenomenon. Not all of our students are applying to or choosing to go to or getting into schools with 3% acceptance rates. But this entire reality, this superiority mentality and everything it brings with it, the stress and the fragility and the overwhelmingness that it brings with it, permeates all of our kids' lives, because every kid is trying for a school, every school is sifting and sorting, and every kid is trying for a school at their level that's requiring them to, I won't say every kid, but most of our kids probably are applying to schools that at whatever level are requiring them to play this game. And I wonder if thinking about excellence versus superiority gives us a way to hold on to those values of striving and driving for something without having that to be linked to this framework that has so many other negative things associated with it. And what it would even look like to try to cultivate that as a school culture.
Right. What it, I think that it's kind of starting with how to fix the problem. And I think that for us in our particular community, I think we have to start by sorting out exactly why or what it is that shapes the modern Orthodox community and its striving. Like, why are kids pushed towards this in the first place? And I think while Professor Markowitz is the meritocracy trap description of what's happening in America is extremely useful and gives a lot of shape to what our issue is. I think that for modern Orthodoxy, they're also, it's kind of multi-determined. There are other aspects to it that I think are important. And before solving it, it feels like important to identify what some of those are, because to start with two things that come to mind, I think that we all know that living a modern Orthodox lifestyle is very expensive. It's extremely expensive. In ways that are different than a liberal Jewish lifestyle that can live anywhere in America, and different than a Haredi religious lifestyle where all classes are represented and all jobs are considered to be acceptable. In the community that we're living in, it is it's expensive for a variety of reasons. I know that the tuition crisis on the private high school front is the common criminal in the discourse. Yeah, that's what we hold most responsible. But I think that there's an entire lifestyle that goes with this that makes modern Orthodox living expensive in a way in which kids now are growing up worried about how they're going to be able to pull all of that off, which includes things that they've become accustomed to because of our community's success. It does include expensive high school. It also includes camps for their children and Pesach programs and going on vacations and all sorts of things that somehow, despite the fact that it's a broad community, the proportion of people who are in that upper elite in the American community, members of the modern Orthodox community that live in that space, is extremely high. And I think that causes kids to assume that they have to get into the best school in order to be able to manage. And I think that in high school, it then becomes not only about kind of human capital, but there's a cultural capital piece to it. Even kids who are not striving to necessarily get into the best colleges, self-esteem is very tied up with how the grades that they're achieving and being able to be perfect. And it's very hard to disrupt that system because it feels like the economics and the value of education become wrapped up and intertwined in a way in which it's hard to disentangle them.
So that tees up perfectly something else that I wanted to raise: the difficulty of disrupting the system, the extent to which it's entangled, the extent to which within the modern Orthodox community, we have particular drivers driving us in this direction. But there is another phenomenon that we see in our community, in our school, a decent chunk of the time. And I think it's interesting to throw it into the mix. So this is another book by a professor at Tulane named Alana Horowitz. The book is called God, Grades, and Graduation: Religion's Surprising Impact on Academic Success. And she's got a fascinating argument about why, in her study of American kids in general — she's studying actually American Christian kids, not American Jewish kids — why religious kids do better in school. The one line summary, she says, they're used to following rules and schools reward rule followers. So that's why religious kids do better in school. But then at some point in her book, she talks about something that I found fascinating, because again, I recognized our kids in it. And she talks about the phenomenon of selecting against selectivity. And those are some of the religious Christian students that she studied, who, although their grades and their scores might have made it possible for them to apply to the most competitive schools, made a religiously motivated choice instead to apply to religious schools or schools that had an environment that would be more conducive to their continued religious development. And so they chose not to apply, you know, to HYP or Stanford and MIT and University of Chicago or wherever else it is they might have been able to get into, because they wanted to go to a specifically religiously appropriate environment. And for some meaningful percentage of our students and for students in our community, despite Rabbi Herzog, all the factors you've laid out kind of pushing the modern Orthodox community in this direction, we see a meaningful percentage of our kids selecting against selectivity. Mm-hmm. And for reasons of religious commitment or the kind of community they want to be in or their desire to engage in ongoing Torah learning after they come back from the year in Israel, are choosing not to apply to the most competitive schools, are choosing to apply again, whether it's because they're choosing to apply to Yeshiva College and Stern College, whether it's because they're choosing to apply to schools with greater Orthodox life, whatever exactly are the factors that are shaping the choices they make. In the middle of all of this that we're talking about the stress, the pressure, the striving and everything else, we also see that. What's interesting is, and this I guess relates to your observation about that it just becomes the social currency, it becomes the environment, it becomes the water we swim in, is the extent to which it doesn't seem like those kids are by and large, you know, off the hamster wheel. It seems like everyone's on the hamster wheel, whatever choices they're making post high school.
Well, it seems to me, I think that when you talk about the students who are making just a reaction to the idea of anti-selectivity, I think it's very hard to have a movement that's based on being anti-something. I think it's really important to have things gain momentum because they're in support of something. Some of the students that you described that make a decision to try to get off the hamster wheel, it is actually driven by a desire to grow in a different kind of way. So someone who would not, when they're in high school, choose to go to Yeshiva University and have a dual curriculum program over the course of college, at some point will decide that because they're motivated the Torah is actually drawing them in, and that's motivating them, and their search for excellence shifts a bit from just being about grades and school and college to being about maybe still grades and school and college, but in the context of a number of different kinds of curricula. So the Jewish side and the general side become mixed together, and people will choose a different path, which is still on the hamster wheel, maybe in some respect, but actually driven by different sets of values. Or maybe it would be fair to say your distinction between excellence and superiority actually plays in. It becomes about excellence, but excellence of a different sort. Now we are pushing towards Torah and general studies. And we know that we've had graduates who decided to drop the college plan altogether and just go to yeshiva. The reason I'm raising this now is not to endorse one path over another, or that the solution to the meritocracy trap is to go just to yeshiva and drop out of college. I think what you see is people striving for excellence in different kinds of ways. And if there's the natural path for education, economic, whatever the reasons are towards college, they end up being replaced, or kids move in a different direction, not just based on kind of the willpower of stepping out and trying to push back, but actually in the name of something positive that they really invested and engaged in. So it seems to me that the only way to you know, move us in a different direction, or at least an important part of moving us in another direction, is to have alternatives of excellence that can allow people to choose different types of paths through which they will grow and strive in different ways than just the one that lies before them kind of most obviously.
Can I just notice something here? So there have been lots of different meritocracies in human history. The Qing dynasty in China had a certain kind of meritocracy based on erudition and classical learning. The Mongol Empire had a certain kind of meritocracy based on martial skill and valor. We have a market meritocracy, which largely associates merit with the capacity to command a wage in the labor market. And our training system is designed to produce this wage earning facility. And the market has now reached back into schools and universities to produce global rankings, you know, the US News rankings of colleges. And that's possible because one of the features of markets is that there's a single measure that ranks everything, which is money. And you can put everybody's income on a rank, and it's all in one dimension, and you go how far you go along the dimension. But applied to education, this is actually a manifest absurdity. You know, the idea that Harvard University, which is a global research university devoted to producing and reproducing the elite, Berea College, which is a US-American college devoted to social mobility, Seattle University, which is a Jesuit university promoting a certain Jesuit conception of public service, and Yeshiva University, which is a Jewish university devoted to a different religious conception of learning and service, should be rankable along one dimension, that it should be intelligible to say that one of them is better than another one, is literally ridiculous. But it's the thing that our society has made seem totally natural. And one great strength that I take the modern Orthodox community to have is because you have a shared commitment to a set of values that is separate from both the rest of society and the market, not isolated from, but distinctive, you may have the cultural power to open up for your students a series of ambitions that don't have to be ranked alongside the other ambitions, so that now they have more degrees of freedom, quite literally, because they can pursue something that is meaningful to them, achieves recognition and esteem in their community, but doesn't have to be set alongside and measured against the one conception of esteem and value that everybody else holds true. And that seems like it's a real possibility that you all have, that say, you know, St. Paul's School does not have, because it's committed to the unidimensional ranking system. Does that seem right to you? Am I catching something that you can invest in and make a difference for your students with, or am I missing the point?
Definitely resonates. It actually brings to mind something that I've thought about. I think maybe it's already a missed opportunity for many years, and that is that while I will always speak here in support of Yeshiva University as a wonderful place for our students to attend, both for the men and the women, it is a separate gendered institution. And in terms of thinking about paths and being able to achieve what it is that you are describing, having different kinds of dual curricular options for our students, or different types of Jewish universities, would really make an enormous difference in the community. I think that some of our students would, there are a variety of reasons why people would choose to go to a secular college rather than to a Jewish college, or, you know, could be just to be able to experience the world in a broader type of way. But if there were different types of Jewish universities, as simply as one where young men and women could go to school together the way that, for example, our students have been raised all of their lives, that would be something different. It would be a path towards striving for that excellence in a Jewish kind of way, where options were broadened as to how it is that I could possibly achieve that.
So Professor Markovitz, when Machon Tziach University 15 years from now is not rising through the ranks of the U.S. News and World Report rankings because we opt out of that because that's not a thing we do, you will know that you were present at the creation. I want to ask one final question, and then I'd like to, if we have a little bit of time, to open up. I'm not sure Matthew's going to help us figure out how we can take questions. And that is, you've been talking, in the beginning of this conversation, we really took it more from the side of all the negative impact this is having on our kids, which again, are all true. And I don't think we need to belabor because we all see them. Now we're talking about the positive side of it, which is that once we get away from superiority and then money ultimately as the way of measuring all success and value, we could think of multiple realms of excellence. Here's a question. It's still a tough sell to say you should give up on striving for those material rewards. Do you think there's anything to the argument based on the work of the late Princeton economist Alan Krueger, who's argued that, who's done a couple of rounds of studies suggesting or saying that there aren't actually significant material rewards that accrue to those who attend elite universities in contrast to those who have applied to and gotten into but not attended? And then later he even said those applied to and didn't get into elite universities. Meaning he's arguing the rewards come to certain kinds of people and certain kinds of students, not to having a certain name on your diploma. And if we could sell that idea, your kids will do just as well if they go to less elite universities, maybe everybody could take a deep breath. But that's actually buying into still money as the merit of everything. Your kid won't lose out financially by going to a less elite university. I'm curious to know, I don't remember whether you addressed this particular study in your book, what you think about that as an argument and what you think about that as a selling point.
Yeah, so I have a two-part response to that. The first is I am a little more dubious of Krueger's empirical identification strategy than some others are. So I'm not persuaded that he's in fact demonstrated that where you attend has as small an impact on your income as he concludes it has. And one of the reasons why I'm more dubious, and this is not a happy, I wish it were true, because if it were true, the argument you're making would be a natural and appealing one. But you know, we live in a society where because of the kinds of rankings that I've been describing, that we've been talking about, very, very few people don't go to the college, the highest ranked college they get into. And relatively few people don't apply to the highest ranked colleges they can realistically go to. And so people who get into one college but go to a much less highly ranked college, or people who in fact just apply systematically to less highly ranked colleges, are often quite unusual in some way or other. And their being unusual, you would think, is going to be connected to the fact that making these choices is actually in their interests. And so the fact that we see that people who don't get into the highest ranked college or go elsewhere or something like that do pretty well, might mean that only that's true only for those for whom that actually happens. And that everybody else, if they didn't go to Harvard when they got into Harvard, probably wouldn't do as well economically. And Krueger's method can't, I think, handle that identification problem. So that's a sort of technical reason why I'm a little dubious on that. But here's something that I'm less dubious of. You don't actually need as much money to flourish as most people in our culture think you need to flourish. So the best data suggests that at a household income of roughly $175,000 a year, after that, there's almost no correlation anymore between more money and more flourishing. And $175,000 a year is quite a lot of income. You know, it's maybe 2.5 times the median household income. But it's not $500,000 a year or $1 million a year or $2 million a year. It's not the kind of income that Yale Law School graduates try to get. And so I think it turns out that people, the upper middle class in the United States, is chasing income, often at great cost to themselves, where the actual human benefit of getting the income they're chasing is almost zero. And another way to think about freeing oneself from this system is to try to internalize that lesson and to realize that not in some sort of woolly-minded way, you know, one can live on air and rocks, but rather, no, money matters to flourishing and well-being up to a point. And beyond that point, it actually doesn't matter at all. And if one can figure out where that point is and then stop chasing it, that's also a way to get quite a lot of freedom and well-being.
Before you, Dr. Schwartz, go to questions, I just wanted to add one point, because I think that one of the things that is extremely important and feels very compelling about this conversation and approach is the way in which the problem is not an SAR high school problem. It is actually an American problem. And that's what Dr. Markovitz is, Professor Markovitz has described in all of this, which makes me think about the way the different countries actually think about high school in particular. I find myself often reflecting on the difference between going to high school in Israel and going to high school in America. When educators come to the States and visit our school, they always are so amazed at how seriously our students take school. They really enjoy learning. They love to learn. And they participate, and they don't look like they're sad about it. They actually look like it's a vibrant and happy place of learning. And that's wonderful to hear that. And at the same, and I think that actually is a very strong benefit of this system that we have here in the United States. At the same time, I find it very striking that part of the reason why in Israel high school is taken less seriously is because when you're in high school, the question you're asking yourself is not what college, what am I going to do for university, but how am I going to serve the country? Am I going to serve the country through the army, or am I going to do public service, community service? And so the mindset is so shaped by what's happening immediately following in terms of what the priorities are and what you're seeking to do. And not that it's a binary, choose this one or that one, but it does, I think, point to, we have a tendency to kind of place blame here. So, you know, parents will say, why is the school drumming up college so much like we're doing here? We're talking about it for an hour. And some can say that it's the parents, and why is it the kids? There's a whole system here that's very hard to pull out of. It's actually a national system that's very deeply entrenched. And thinking about how different national systems, like one that's very close to us in Israel, functions differently is interesting. And then thinking about how subcultures within our Orthodox community, such as the Haredi community, which prioritizes other things and therefore can make different choices. There are, I think it has to be thought of in a large kind of way, and thinking about different communal paths that we can push within the institution.
I will say that before this evening, Rabbi Hartzark and I spoke a number of times about managing expectations. I probably should have started the evening with this. If you came here thinking that by now we were going to give you the solution as to how to lessen your children's stress levels, make sure that everybody makes it, and solve the problems of meritocracy for our community and American society, I'm sorry that it's taken me 51 minutes to tell you that we aren't, in fact, going to be able to do that tonight. Having said that, I will say that even, you know, just, and so we had this conversation about what are we going to be able to feel like we came away from this evening with if we aren't going to solve the whole problem? Does it feel like we've just gathered to hand-wring? I think even the framing of the distinction between excellence and superiority, and the fact that you can be superior at things that aren't worth doing, like, for example, excelling at taking the ACTs or the SATs, which you might need to do to get into college, but are not particularly worthwhile endeavors, I think is something valuable for us to take away with us and think about and figure out how that plays out in life at the school. The one thing I have to raise, because I could hear in my mind's AirPods, 75 people feverishly pounding the unmute button, only to discover they couldn't unmute themselves, is Professor Markovitz, when you gave that $175,000 figure, that may be that in broad studies of American populations, people's happiness doesn't really increase after that number. Another thing that Rabbi Hartzler and I discussed is that we were not going to turn tonight into a lamentation about the tuition crisis, right? That whole conversation about the role that day school tuition plays in the modern Orthodox community, which is an important conversation, was not exactly what this one was intended to be. But I have received messages saying we can't just leave that $175,000 figure to sit, given the tuition in SRI school, to be perfectly frank. And so I think the point is well taken, the point that we could recalibrate what are necessary levels of having, and we can consciously work to recalibrate and reframe what are necessary levels of having and spending, and recognize that above a certain level, money might serve more of a function of keeping score than anything else, but also recognizing that what that absolute level is might look different in a community where there is a normalized expectation that everyone is going to send their kids to yeshiva day school, private schools, and what the tuition in that schools look like.
Well, so I think I have two kinds of reactions. One is individual and the other is collective. At the individual level, you know, if I were having this conversation among a group of people who are sending their kids to Brearley, they would also say, wait a minute, we need more money because sending our kids to Brearley is an essential part of flourishing, given our social circle, our values, our cultural sets of ideals, our ethical conception of ourselves and our families. Now, my own gut instinct is that a group that is a distinctive religious, cultural, belief, ethical, faith community of some sort has a more credible claim to say that it's essential that it sends its children to a distinctively structured educational institution than a group that is held together by being part of a basically secular capitalist elite. But I think if you talk to people in the secular capitalist elite, they might not think that. And so one set of questions to ask is, well, what actually is essential? And, you know, if one sent one's children to a different kind of school, are there other ways to get the religious sensibilities and practices that one wants? And would people actually be less well off and actually less happy and actually flourish less? So I don't know. I mean, I get the sentiment that maybe the answer is yes, but we should all be open to self, to reflective self-criticism about whether the answer really is yes. So that's one set of the second more collective thought is, you know, there are different ways to structure all these schools, and they can be run in more expensive and less expensive ways. And obviously running a school is expensive, but my guess is, for example, your student teacher ratio is pretty favorable. It could be run that's a lot less favorable and still produce the ethical and religious sensibilities that you're after. And that would make it a lot cheaper. It wouldn't make it as effective at getting kids into Princeton or Harvard. But it would make it a lot cheaper, and it might still serve some of these other values. And so again, I don't want to back off. You know, I'm not insisting on $175,000. You know, that's the average of a set of social psychological studies and whatever, right? But it is the case that we all believe that many expensive things are essential to our well-being, that are in fact not essential to our well-being. And the question is just which ones and how essential. And I'm part of that too. I have all sorts of views about what my children need and what my family needs for flourishing that are expensive. And my guess is my beliefs about that are actually false. Although it's hard to persuade myself of that in the face of all the structures that we are in?
I do feel the need to say that that although it is true that our teacher-student ratio is actually quite favorable compared to the public school system, our cost per student is actually pretty much in line with the what New York City pays or cost per student for public school system. And
Look, I'm not,
sounds defensive, but just important to say it out loud before everybody goes on there.
I totally get that. And you guys are taking a chance inviting me to come here. So you know,
I for one will say that I really appreciate this. Meaning we brought you here in a certain sense to challenge our kids' core beliefs and assumptions, and you're poking at us to challenge ours. And no, we're not shutting down SAR High School tomorrow and telling everybody to send their kids to public school in Talmadora. And all of these things are still worth thinking about.
I mean, I'm challenging my own too, right? I mean, I live a certain life that is more expensive, that seems to me compelling and important. And I'm not sure that I can really justify those sensibilities if I push hard on them.
I think this has been a really, really interesting and rich and thought-provoking discussion. I think I think that our concern that it would just feel like we were hand-wringing but didn't have any avenues for thinking better or more clearly or differently about this have not been realized. I think I will speak only for myself, and the rest of us can gather and discuss it later. I think I feel like there are new and different and interesting ways for me to think about the conundrum in which we find ourselves and the way out of it. I'm deeply grateful to you, Professor Markovitz, for taking your time. I will close only because it's the last thing we've been sitting on by saying there is yet another way of solving this problem. And it is one that is actively being worked towards by a friend of Machon Siach and your colleague, professor of Pepperdine Law School and Yale Law School, Michael Avi Helfand, which is getting the government of the United States and the government of the states to think differently about how they support the parts of religious day schooling that are serving secular government purposes. And obviously that's yet another whole entire conversation, but worth putting out there. But I don't really want us to end, although that was where the conversation got at the very end.
Can I just give a plug for Michael Helfand?
Sure, of course.
You know, who is great, who was my student years and years ago, and is now my colleague, and I'm a huge fan of his. So I'm so glad to hear his name invoked.
Great, terrific. I will. I spoke to him earlier today. I will tell him that this came up in conversation. So I do want to go back a little bit to some of the bigger issues that we talked about the nature of the lives our kids are living and the choices and trade-offs they're making. And Ezra Beharstar kept bringing up the fact that this is not our kids in their school, but a broader structure, a broader community, and a broader society they're embedded in. And the ways in which, even if we're not going to change all of American society, we can think about communicating more clearly and directly about what our specific values are and how they can shape the choices our kids make, in the ways we as schools function, the way we as families and communities function, in ways that hopefully get us a little bit away from the kinds of alienation or rat race or hamster wheel we talked about in the beginning, and towards kids feeling maybe that they have more options, more paths, and more ways to live out different kinds of values. Thank you so much, Professor Markovitz, for joining us this evening. Thank you to all of you for being part of this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Grand Conversation. Please be sure to visit our website, www.machonsiach.org, where you can subscribe to our podcast and find all of our work, papers, essays, podcasts, on a whole variety of subjects. Until next time, this has been The Grand Conversation, the Machon Siach Podcast.